Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. We'll do that in just a moment. First, 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put naysayers right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X, brand new question every day from the news of the day. Should Americans under domestic violence restraining orders possess guns? The U.S. Supreme Court today, in an 8-1 decision, upheld a federal law that bars people who are accused of domestic violence but have not had a trial or due process or anything like that from possessing firearms. Now, that's an interesting one, but we'll talk about that a bit later. But the question for now, should Americans under domestic violence restraining orders possess firearms? The Supreme Court says no. Federal law says no. I'm going to say, yeah, they should. Until they get due process, no man or woman's life, liberty, or property should be taken by the U.S. government until that need has been met. But the Supreme Court went the other direction, so I guess I'm on the losing end of that one. Today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show. And I've asked Brad Benton to join me today, who's running for the state legislature, and he's a very strong advocate for property rights. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me.
And I should say you're running not for the House, but for the state Senate to represent District 18. And you've taken property rights as one of your key campaign issues. Would you mind explaining to my audience, number one, where they can find your campaign on social media? And number two, why is property rights one of the hallmarks of your campaign?
Thanks, Lars. So like you said, I'm Brad Benton. I'm running for the state Senate in the 18th District. People can find me at bradbentonforsenate.com. They can go to my Facebook page, Brad Benton for Senate, and check me out. Most importantly, I want to make sure that I'm accessible to people and I can hear about the issues that are important to them. So they can call me, 360-931-4574. Now, when it comes to property rights, the state legislature in Washington this last year led a full-on assault against our individual freedoms and personal property rights. Whether it's the stove in your kitchen, the gas stove that they want to take away, or your ability to legally own a firearm. Those rights are under attack. And Republicans in the state legislature, specifically the Republicans that represent the 18th district, have failed us. All right? I'm in this race because we need somebody in this 18th district Senate seat that's going to go to Olympia and fight for us, fight for the people, and fight for their rights. That's why I got involved in this in the first place, because we do not have vocal representation and leadership there standing up to the liberal agenda in Olympia. And sometimes that means standing up to the Republican establishment, too.
I agree with you, because, Brad, I for the life of me, I don't understand how people get elected as Republicans and then they go off to Salem in Oregon or Olympia in Washington, maybe not as often to Boise in Idaho, and they start behaving like Democrats, trying to find every way they can to be as Democrat-like as they can, and I don't understand that. Do you have a take on why that seems to happen?
You know, in my race, I'm in a contested race with another Republican. Greg Cheney currently represents the 18th as the member of the House, and he wants to move over to the Senate. But the fact of the matter is if you look at Greg Cheney's voting record, the American Conservative Union put out their scorecard. He's the lowest ranking member of the Republican caucus in the House at a 55% rating. He's hardly a Republican. He's certainly not a conservative. And what it comes down to is if you do not have a set of values and principles and a backbone, when you go to Olympia, you will not find it there. We have to send somebody who has those values, has those principles, and has that backbone so that they can go and actually do the people's work who sent them there. And that's what my campaign is all about.
No, I agree with you. Brad, tell them where to find you on social media again, because I think even this Supreme Court decision today is a good example of one that's going to challenge people's beliefs and their values. And maybe we can get into that. But where do they find you again?
So my Facebook page is Brad Benton for Senate. My website is bradbentonforsenate.com. You can email me, brad@bradbentonforsenate.com. And when it comes to the Second Amendment, you are going to have a fighter and an ally up in Olympia if you send me there. And pretty soon my ranking is going to come out with the NRA, and I'm fairly certain it's going to be an A-plus ranking with them.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm an NRA member. I've also quit the group at times when I had real deep value-based disagreements with them. In one case, it was First Amendment, where the NRA was tossing the First Amendment rights of gun groups under the bus in exchange for its own rights, which I also don't believe in. But this decision today, if I ask you just generically, hey, Brad, if there's a guy who beats his girlfriend, should he be able to have a gun? I think both of those would probably say, nah, it doesn't sound like a good idea. On the other hand, I'm also aware that domestic violence restraining orders get abused by both men and by women. And that sometimes they're granted without a whole lot of due process or any of the other rights that are spelled out in the Constitution. And yet I know why some conservatives are going to say, yeah, they were right today. Keep the guns out of the hands of those with, you know, who are accused of but have not been adjudicated of any crime whatsoever. And there was only one dissent. It was Thomas who pointed that out. He said, look, you're taking civil rights from people who have not had any due process at all.
Exactly.
And all the things like the right to confront your accuser, to call evidence or call witnesses on your own behalf. And so you have to take that uncomfortable position of saying, yeah, that may leave guns in the hands of both abusive men and abusive women, because women do abuse at times. And it's a tough one. But if you remember what your values are, yeah, you want to take somebody's life, liberty, property without due process, that's an automatic no. But the Supreme Court today said yes.
Exactly. Well, you know, it's important to make sure that dangerous people don't have access to firearms. However, you cannot have your rights taken away if you are not given due process, right? That's what the Constitution guarantees. And that's why we need people at all levels of government that are going to uphold and defend the Constitution. You know, the federal Constitution, the state Constitution here in Washington. We need patriots that are going to take up that fight.
And we need Republicans who are going to actually go to Salem and Olympia and stand by their values and not simply put their finger up in the air and see which way the wind is blowing. Brad, thanks for coming on. I very much appreciate the time.
Thanks, Lars. I appreciate it.
And that is Brad Benton, who is running as a Republican against another Republican, but he says that Republican is not much to write home about. I'll be glad to talk to Mr. Cheney if he wants to come on the program, but I'm going to ask him a few hard questions if he does that. Glad to get your calls on a First Amendment Friday at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. I think it's notable that there is something terrible going on all over America right now involving hospitals and children. And what it involves is chemical castration of children through puberty blockers and even surgery on children, including little boys and little girls. It's all done in the name of gender affirmation. And while most of the reporters out there are out just singing the praises. Isn't it great that this hospital or that hospital is doing gender affirmation of these tiny children whose parents have gone along with the notion that a little boy has suddenly decided that he's a little girl. And now he's going to make some life-changing decisions, life-altering decisions at the ripe old age of 8 or 10 or 12. Well, there are a few journalists who are actually chasing this down. And one of them is Jonathan Cho, who works with the Discovery Institute as a journalist, a Manhattan Institute Logos fellow, and the guy who's been trying to get inside Texas Children's Hospital. Jonathan joins me now. Jay Cho, how are you?
Hey, Lars. I never imagined I'd be talking to you from Houston, Texas, which is where I'm at right now.
And you've gone to Houston, Texas, because you wanted to ask probably some fairly simple, straightforward questions about the folks who run Texas Children's Hospital. Can you tell my audience about that investigation?
Yeah, this has been actually going on for more than a year now. My colleague Christopher Rufo with Manhattan Institute and City Journal, as well as several other journalists part of this fellowship who are work for Daily Wire, National Review, and several other outlets, we've essentially formed a super team of independent journalists to really look into what's happening at Texas Children's Hospital. The headline here, Lars, is that AG Ken Paxton, here in Texas, launched a Medicaid fraud investigation into Texas Children's Hospital surrounding this gender clinic. And essentially, the doctors involved at the center of this, doctors David Paul and Richard Roberts, they're accused of essentially cooking the books. Because in Texas, you're not allowed to use Medicaid money to essentially do these types of sex change procedures. And I want to be very clear. Right now, Texas Children's Hospital, not cutting off any genitals or anything like that. But right now, what they are doing is they're allegedly, or they were, putting in puberty blockers. And that's not allowed. So again, the AG launching an investigation, and my responsibility as one of the journalists on the ground here was simply confront the CEO, Mark Wallace. And I try to do that this entire week, but every step of the way, he's calling the cops on.
So you show up to the hospital asking questions about a public institution, and just so we know, Texas Children's is a private nonprofit, or it's not a for-profit hospital, is it?
Yeah, it's a private institution, and at the same time, again, the allegation is that they're using taxpayer dollars to perform these types of procedures, and that's not allowed in the state of Texas.
No, so you've got, and Texas Children's a fairly major institution, isn't it? And it's not a small operation. This isn't some little, you know, clinic with a couple of doctors. This is a big operation. And they're saying, we don't want to explain to the public whether or not we may be illegally using government money, both state and federal money under Medicaid, to be able to accomplish this puberty blocking activity. Are you fair, you know, and it seems like that if the institution was not guilty of doing those things, they want to say so. Say, no, we're not misusing this money. And yet if the AG has opened up an investigation, that at least suggests that there's a strong possibility that they are breaking the law.
Yeah, you know, and again, Texas Children's, one of the largest children's hospitals in the nation, in Houston and Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, just a presence all over Texas right now that I'm learning myself being on the ground here. They're also affiliated with a Baylor School of Medicine, Baylor College of Medicine. And shockingly, just by coincidence, doctors David Paul and Richard Ross also teaching at that institution, but their bios were suddenly scrubbed this week from the website. And the explanation we got was from the school that the faculty and staff have the authority to remove their bios. But again, they wouldn't answer whether or not the two doctors were still affiliated with the school. And the gender clinic this week, just yesterday, abruptly shut down temporarily, reopened this morning. And when I went in to see if doctors David Paul and Richard Roberts, who are working in pediatric endocrinology and are at the center of this investigation, if they were working, mysteriously, they weren't working today. And when I asked the receptionist when they'd return, she had no idea. And the final bizarre twist in this is that the Texas Children's Hospital PR page was up just a couple days ago, but suddenly it's nowhere to be found now. So bottom line, Lars, is that Texas Children's Hospital is supposed to be one of the largest, most sophisticated children's hospitals in America, has been caught with its pants down, and they're now in crisis management mode.
Now, let me ask you about one other issue, and that is, Jonathan, are they only working on kids in Texas, or is Texas Children's actually reaching out to other parts of America, saying, if you can't do it in your state, bring your kids here, and we'll do it here instead of in your home state?
Yeah, you know, that part is unclear, but what really launched, you know, our investigation on the ground with the reporting is that a whistleblower, one of the doctors, Dr. Heim, stepped forward and spoke to Christopher Rufo last year and was basically saying, hey, look, you know, the state of Texas, it's illegal to do these, you know, puberty blocker procedures in minors, but it's still going on. So that is the key that essentially launched all of this. There's just so much more to this. We've scratched the surface only. And I want to point out, Lars, that it's the independent journalists right now from outside Texas who are really digging into this. Local media barely touching the story right now.
Let me ask you this. The doctor you mentioned who's the whistleblower, is this the same doctor who just recently ended up with the FBI on his front doorstep asking, we want to talk to you about the things you've had to say? Is that the same case?
It is related. That is actually a nurse, though, also at Texas Children's Hospital. She's also the second whistleblower in this, and the FBI showed up to her door to allegedly intimidate her to not cooperate with reporters on this matter. But the doctor right now, Ethan Heim, is now facing multiple federal charges. In other words, the Biden administration and the trans ideology they're pushing is now going after Heim for being a whistleblower, accusing him of HIPAA violations.
Yeah, but if all he's doing is saying you should be aware this kind of procedure is going on there, how's that a HIPAA violation? I mean, if I go and get my ankle operated on and they do the operation, they said we did an ankle operation last week, that doesn't violate my HIPAA rights if they don't tell my name and, you know, and other personal information. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, that makes all the sense in the world, but the feds allege that they have more than that, and there have been some violations here. I'm pleading not guilty to the four federal charges, basically being charged also with going into the electronic system and causing malicious harm. So that hasn't really been defined yet. Again, these vague charges are still waiting for all the details to come out. Again, this is really problematic, and if this does not work out for Mr. Heim, it will have a chilling effect on other whistleblowers, especially in the space.
No doubt about that. That's Jonathan Cho. He's a journalist with the Discovery Institute investigating puberty blockers illegally being done with federal and state money in the state of Texas. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show. Lots of folks worry about their firearms, but Lars doesn't have to worry about Biden taking his guns. He stores them upstairs. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Big iron on his heel.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And it's great to have you with me on the program. If you want to dial in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. We'll get to calls here in just a moment. But I think one of the most disastrous policies ever adopted, and it was pushed by the great Barack Hussein Obama, who said more than a decade ago that he would solve homelessness by one policy, and he would push that policy on every city in America that gets federal housing money from Housing and Urban Development. And that policy was housing first, meaning that if you find somebody who's homeless, drug addicted, mentally ill, and everything else, you get them housing first, and then you worry about the addiction and the other problems later on. And it's been a disastrous policy. Not only did it not solve homelessness in a decade, as Obama promised it would, it's actually made it worse. And so I was really gratified to see that there's a group that is pushing across the state of Washington, and I hope the whole same thing happens in Oregon, that says, let's do treatment first instead. And Nate Nearing joins me now. Nate, welcome to the program, and explain to my audience what you do and why you're involved in this effort.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program. I really appreciate it, Lars.
You bet.
The director for Future 42's Snohomish County Project. And one of the things that we've been doing is working on, as you said, a treatment-first approach to homelessness. You know, we've seen the failed progressive policies of housing first and harm reduction when it comes to folks who are struggling on the street with homelessness and addiction and mental illness. And as you said, we've only gone backward as millions and really hundreds of millions throughout the Puget Sound region and all throughout the West Coast have been poured into these progressive programs. We've only seen increases in homelessness, increases in drug overdose deaths, and increases in crime rates. And so I think what's abundantly clear is that we need to try something different. And that's exactly what this Real Solutions to Homelessness pledge that we have put forward and encouraged local elected officials to sign on to does.
And you're trying to get government officials to sign on to this. So you're going to cities and counties and other jurisdictions saying, sign on to this and abandon the housing first idea?
That's correct. Yeah, local government is really where the rubber meets the road on this issue in terms of the response to homelessness and addiction. And so we've approached city council members, county officials, and others in local government throughout the state, encouraging them to sign on. And there's a ton of great momentum so far. I think we've got just about 60 elected officials in Washington State who have already signed on to the pledge.
Have you been able to get any actual governments? That is, you've gone to individual politicians or elected folks. Have you been able to get a county or a city or other agencies to sign on and say, yeah, that's the right approach instead of what Puget Sound is doing, instead of what Portland is doing?
Yeah, it's a good question. We have not approached governments as a whole. We've been approaching individual elected officials to encourage them to sign on to this. And then the hope is that if they sign on, the pledge outlines 7 specific policy approaches that can be taken.
By the way, I love your list. I love the list you put together. Tell my audience what's on it.
Sure, yeah, just a few examples. I won't go through the whole thing. You can view it online by searching Future 42 Real Solutions to Homelessness Pledge. But just a couple of examples are, when subsidized housing is from the taxpayers is being given, we require treatment for the individual who's struggling with addiction receiving that housing. Another is defunding harm reduction programs such as heroin injection sites or outlawing them through land use measures. Another is mandatory minimum sentencing for repeat offenders. And then there's a few others as well that deal with panhandling and encampments and so on and so forth. And so the idea is get local elected officials to sign on to this, and then when they go back to their city or county, whatever their jurisdiction is, they can take these policies, and we've got examples of cities and counties that have actually adopted these successfully, and so we can hand the local elected official the language they need to propose, and then they can, of course, adjust that however they like. The idea would be they take that then to their jurisdiction, introduce it, and hopefully get some of these things passed, and as we see that momentum begin to build throughout the state, I think we'll see a shift in the approach to these critical issues and hopefully see some good progress.
See, I'm hoping that you get a couple of county commissioners who go back to their county commission and say, why shouldn't we adopt this approach? And that the other county commissioners say, well, you say, let's put it to a vote. How many people in favor of saying, if you're drug addicted and you're going to get subsidized housing, you need to get into treatment, and we'll give the housing, or you know, allow the housing, whatever way it's given, to those people who are willing to take treatment. Otherwise, the problem isn't solved. All you've got is a heroin addict who's now living in subsidized housing. But if you get somebody who's in treatment and arguably able to maybe beat the drug, and the reward is to get some subsidized housing and all the other goodies that come with it, at least you're making some progress. Put that to a vote in most counties. I would think some county commissioners, even the more liberal ones, would say, well, I can't very well vote against that. It's too sensible, right?
I think that's exactly right. And as you said at the beginning of the show, you know, the housing first idea of let's just get somebody under shelter and then we don't have to worry about anything else. We don't have to deal with the underlying drug addiction or mental illness. It's just pure fiction. That's not going to solve anything. And we've seen that, you know, in places like Seattle and throughout the Puget Sound and in the entire West Coast, really, where we've not only not made any progress, but we've actually gone backwards. And so I think this idea, you know, if you're looking at somebody who's perhaps a victim of domestic violence or a family who's down on their luck financially, yeah, housing first might work great for folks in those situations. But when we're talking about somebody with a severe addiction to something like fentanyl or meth or heroin, the idea that we can just hand them a room key and say, you know, go enjoy your new unit or hotel or whatever it is, and that's going to solve their underlying issues is just absurd. And so we're seeing, you know, drug contamination in a lot of these units that people are using. We're seeing overdose deaths in these units. And so we really need to look at a more comprehensive treatment-first approach, specifically when we're looking at folks who are dealing with drug addiction with fentanyl.
I'm talking to Nate Nearing, who's the Sonoma County Director for Future 42, with the treatment-first. You know, Nate, I mentioned from time to time, my dad's long gone, but he was a hardcore alcoholic. And when Tina and I found an apartment for him in the Portland area years ago, when he came to this area for a while, the last thing I would have done was put him over the liquor store or in between two other apartments with guys in it who like to booze. It's just a bad idea. And I just wonder the thinking of the people who have the low barrier. That's the euphemism for you can still shoot heroin and use fentanyl if you live in this housing, that you put, even if somebody was trying hard to beat the drugs, and you say, we're going to put you in a building that's full of other drug addicts who are allowed to continue using drugs. Oh, and by the way, you're probably a target for all the drug sellers because they know where all their customers are. It seems like it's designed to sabotage the person, even the rare person who might say, well, I'm going to try to get clean now.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. It's hard to fathom the logic behind it. I don't know if there is any. King County Executive Gal Constantine just last week made a comment, and I think it was the State of the County address that you know.
By the way, Joel, see if you can find that soundbite because I wanted to play it. But go ahead, Nate. Tell him what this idiot said. I'm sorry. I'm going to call him an idiot. You don't have to.
Essentially, what he said is that, you know, there's a significant homeless problem, but drug addiction and mental illness don't play a role. There is no underlying drug addiction, mental illness issue, which is just, it's pure fiction, right? There's, you know, there's nothing to back that up. There's reports nationally of self-identified, you know, individuals who are homeless who will self-identify that they have an issue with drug addiction or mental illness over 50%. So the truth of the matter is a vast majority of people who are on the streets are addicted to drugs or struggling with mental illness or some combination of the two. But, you know, when elected officials say things like that, like drugs aren't part of the problem, mental illness isn't part of the problem, and then they go and propose solutions that don't do anything for those who are struggling with drugs or mental illness, that's when you get the problems that we're seeing throughout the Puget Sound and the West Coast.
Nate, the idea was the pet idea of that great constitutional scholar, Barack Obama. And so much of what he did worked out so very, very wrong. Nate, keep up the good work. We're going to direct people to the website. We'll share the list. It's a great list of requirements. If you want public housing, you're going to have to get in the treatment program. If you're not in treatment, you don't get the taxpayer-funded housing. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The 40th President of the United States always knew where to put the blame.
You have blamed mistakes of the past, and you blame the Congress. Does any of the blame belong to you?
Yes, because for many years I was a Democrat.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, would you be willing to drink recycled sewage water provided by your local government as your drinking water? Portland may be on its way to doing that. Ted Wheeler announcing today that they're going to explore the one water approach for delivering what Ted Wheeler calls holistic water, sewer, and storm water. And when I went to the website of the non-governmental private organization that does this called the U.S. Water Alliance, they explained that, one of the biggest ideas is wastewater recycled into drinking water. I know. Sounds tasty, doesn't it? To your calls, and our first naysayer this hour. Jeff, welcome to the program. We love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer today?
Oh, I just think, like, the opening of your show, you should change it a little bit. Like, when it opens up with, you know, where Trump saying we're going to get rid of the Biden crime family, there should be a pause, and then we're going to replace it with the Trump crime family.
Hmm. Can you tell me what crimes we're talking about?
Just in future, the future crime family.
Future crime. Anyway, that sounds like a movie like Minority Report. Is there such a thing as anticipating the future crimes of Donald Trump?
Well, you know, already his convictions for all his other crimes, you know.
Oh, conviction for fraud where nobody lost any money and the alleged victims wanted to do business with him again? That fraud?
And him and none of his family are allowed to sit on any of the boards of any charities in this country because of the fraud that they perpetrated there. But anyway, what I called about was,
yeah,
do you think if Trump's mental acuity goes down to the point like Biden was, do the Republican establishment have the nerve to take him out?
Sure.
And if it looks like Harris is going to win it in a walkaway, a runaway, do you think Trump is going to accept losing and accept defeat? Or is he going to walk away?
As long as they don't cheat.
Do you think he's going to walk away and quit? Or is he going to face the ignominy of losing to a woman?
No, I think, you know, Jeff, to give you an honest answer, I know you're being kind of snarky, but I refuse to join you in that. I think that if Donald Trump were...
No, I'm serious. I am serious.
Well, I'm serious, too.
Serious.
I think if Donald Trump legitimately lost the election, and there's no cheating the way there was in 2020, that Trump will still stay involved in the public sphere. I think he's a powerful force in American politics. And I think that he will stay involved. Just to answer your theoretical question, let me ask you a question based on what you said. Do you think Kamala Harris is going to win running away with it in November?
I do not know. That's one thing. But with you seeing, I mean...
Well, hold on. You asked me a hypothetical. I answered it. You just dodged mine. Let me ask you this. Do you plan to vote for Kamala
Harris? I'll answer your question, the hypothetical.
Yeah.
If she gets the support from the log cabin Republicans, the other Republicans, and all the other people that are flocking to her, plus minorities, and everybody else that you possibly see that's going to her, it could be a runaway, and yes, she could walk away with this.
Well, then, Jeff, let me ask you this.
Not that she will, but she could.
Am I right in guessing you plan to vote for Kamala Harris?
Yes, because I think...
Well, no, I don't want the because. I just wanted to find out, if you're voting for Kamala, what is it you see in her that makes you think she'd be a competent president?
It's not what I see in her. It's I truly believe this country cannot survive 4 years of Donald Trump and Matt Gaetz.
Well,
Kamala.
Tell me something, Jeff, be honest. During the last 3.5 years, have your prospects, financial or otherwise, improved?
Mine has stayed the same.
Oh, it stayed the same. So you didn't go down.
I'm old and retired. I'm 70. I'm retired and I'm on Social Security.
I assume you still
eat. I don't have a lot of money. I'm not in the stock market.
Jeff, I assume you still eat, right?
Oh, yes.
Food is up 21%. Is your food budget able to handle that?
Okay, let's
yes or no. Start with yes or no. Answer the question, then give me the explanation.
Prices have gone up for different reasons. Okay.
Has your income gone up enough to keep you in the same place you were 3.5 years ago?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't really check on it that.
Look, I would think if my income had gone up 21% or, you know, let's say 19% in the last 3 years, I'd notice. And I can guarantee you, Jeff, my income did not go up 19% in the last 3 years. Are you telling me that you say you're okay for money? Your income would go up by 19% and you didn't notice?
I know you want to change the subject. And
no, I'm asking you a serious question.
No, I know you want to deflect. You want to deflect from what I was talking about.
Well, what do you want to talk about next?
Being able to survive.
What was
Trump.
The other thing you want to bring up? Something new. What?
No, about surviving Trump for the next 4 years.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to. Is when you say surviving, let me ask you this: during the 4 years of Donald Trump, what went wrong with your life that caused you to say surviving Trump? What terrible things happened to you during the 4 years of Trump?
I'll tell you what Trump did strategically that was so incompetent and ignorant. He didn't recognize and allow the Kurds a country. He turned them over to his buddy Erdogan. We could have had an ally with the Kurds.
Hold on. How did that affect your life, Jeff? I mean, I'm asking about things involving your life and your child. I like the Kurds, too. I think they're a great group of people, and they deserve their own country. But that's the biggest thing on your list is the future of the Kurds. I'm asking you, can you still pay your bills with everything going up so much in just 3 years?
You want to talk about what you want to talk about?
I'm asking, Jeff, you're telling me that we can't survive 4 years of Donald Trump, and your number one concern is whether or not the Kurds, and I am sympathetic to the Kurds, but your number one concern is whether or not the Kurds have a country or not. And I'm asking you, can you feed yourself or not? I think mine's more relevant. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get you your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to talk about universal basic income, and Oregon is going to at least flirt with that idea. This one is not something you could live on, but $750 a year for every person who can fog a mirror. Every man, woman, and child in the state would get $750 a year. And you say, what's the catch, Lars? The catch is to add a brand new tax on corporations, only the big ones, not the little ones, and that would have the result of bringing in enough money to hand out checks to everybody in the state. It sounds like about, might be, for a family of four, that'd be about $3,000 a year. It's not an inconsiderable sum. It's not something you could live on either. And I think it's a terrible idea. But it appears it now has the signatures to make the ballot. So I wanted to talk to Oregon Representative Court Boyce, who's a Republican representing Oregon's District 1 and running to retain his seat. Court, welcome back.
Well, Lars, thanks for having me on. I'm not on the river or at Salem today, but I'm in Gold Beach. It is gorgeous. So, yeah, I've been following this. Businesses are already leaving, corporations, companies, and they're taking their brightest and best, most productive people with them. And so, obviously, the ones that stay, they're just going to pass additional costs on to the consumer.
Yeah, and that's the thing, Court. When they say, and by the way, Court and I have known each other, I think, long enough, probably 45 years, that I think I can call him Court instead of Representative Boyce. But the thing I don't get is people sometimes will come to me and say, hey, I've got this great idea to make energy. And it's a perpetual motion machine where you don't get anything new out. You just make stuff go around and around and around. And I thought, you're going to raise a tax on all companies making corporations grossing more than $25 million a year. Well, that means every big grocery chain is going to hit. Maybe small grocery stores would not be hit, but Plaid would get hit, Safeway would get hit, Albertsons, Freddy's, Kroger, whatever. Every big company that you buy gasoline from or that you buy groceries from or clothing from is going to pay this tax. And then they're just going to pass the tax on to the very people who are getting what amounts to about $65 a month. And I don't see how that gets anybody ahead, do you?
Well, it also includes kids, for goodness sakes. There's a movement. It's not that strong yet, but this is just a start. You mentioned the $25 million threshold. It will be passed on to other businesses, and they're already, because of the anti-business climate in Oregon, Lars, operating on very small margins. And yep. So, yeah, it's not a good idea. It's another thing that puts Oregon in the blue category that people are leaving. And it's just a strong fight that we have to take on and to convince the citizens. This is, you do not vote against your own best interest.
By the way, Court, do you think it's fair to call this idea, even though this one will be voted on by the citizens, and it sounds like they do have the signatures, the number they need to get it on the ballot in November, this will be a CAT tax 2.0, because the corporate activity tax came along, and they said, we're going to charge you a tax not on how much money you make, not on your profits, but on your gross sales. And that was, I think, 0.58, so a little, about almost two-thirds of 1%. This is going to be six times as big or five times as big. And that tax by itself seems to have driven out most of the Bi-Mart, I think all of the Bi-Mart pharmacies, other companies that have high gross revenues but low margins. And this is just going to take that to town again and say, okay, now we're going to take the rest of you and we're going to tell you Oregon is an unfriendly place for you to do business, because we're not taxing you on what you make. We're taxing you on how many total dollars flow through your business, which means a business that may be making a 2 or 3% margin, like a grocery store that's part of a chain that grosses over $25 million a year, may be told your entire net profit goes to the state. And now you're going to have to raise prices. Otherwise, you're running, I guess, a nonprofit grocery store.
You know, that's such a good point. well said. In the legislature, this is not to be negative, but so few understand the difference that have not been in business before, have not employed people, Lars, the difference between gross profits or gross revenue and profits. And so there you have it. It's our founding fathers, they understood this. This is why they warned us that when the citizens of the people understand that they can vote themselves a piece of the pie, it will collapse the republic. So that's why they set up the republic form of government. However, they didn't allow necessarily that well for the citizens initiative. And as I said, I think this is just a start. So yeah, this is a battle that we have to take on and let the citizens know this is really bad business.
Well, and imagine this, Court. I'm thinking about home builders. I mean, the state is begging people to build more housing. And then you say, okay, let's say, and I would imagine most of these small home builders or medium-sized home builders are corporations, right? And so you go out and you build a house. Well, an average house in Oregon, I think, is now $500,000. Portland's more like $600,000 or $700,000. How many of those does it take to get a $25 million gross? You know, build 50 houses. You're there. And so you say, yeah, we took in all that money, but we didn't make that money. We just took in a gross. Yes, we sold $25 million worth of houses, but the amount we actually made on that is a tiny fraction of it. And here come initiative, petition 17 saying, yep, and you're going to pay it all to Tina Kotek. And then she's going to send out checks to everybody in the state.
You know, that's another good point. We're desperate to keep the builders and developers and contractors that we have here. You sit here, some of our speeches on the House floor to stop the burden and the overtaxation. You know, taxes, higher taxes have never worked since time began. It takes away the incentive. It takes away the creativity. So, yes, Lars, these people are going with them. And the builders, they just want to go out, of course, and build good quality homes, take good care of the customers. Oregon's not the place for a lot of them. And so not only do we have to keep them from leaving and retain them, we have to figure ways to bring other developers in. And this, just like the chip manufacturers, we spent, are planning to spend millions of dollars so we can compete with Ohio and Tennessee and some of these other states to bring chip manufacturers here. When they get a wind of this, what do you think, what kind of decisions do you think they're going to make regarding relocating in Oregon?
We're talking about Initiative Petition 17. Its sponsors say they've got the 135,000 signatures. If they qualify for the ballot, it goes on the ballot in November. One last thing, Court. The region has spent hundreds of millions, well, it's actually spent billions on the homeless. Now, nothing about this program would disqualify a drug addict living in a tent by the side of I-5 from getting this check, right? They'd still get the same check, wouldn't they?
I think we have to assume that, Lars, and there's another registered voter. There's also movement for those folks to vote. There's also movement that the in prison people should be able to vote. We can go talk about that another time, but it's just an indication of how far out of mainstream Oregon has gone. We've got to swing it back, and that means we've got to get a conservative House majority and hopefully on the Senate too, and bring Oregon back to common sense, good business, and logic.
Representative Court Boyce, who's running for re-election in District 1. It is an election year, folks, and elections have consequences. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Reynolds Defense.
Nixon was wrong about a lot of things, but he's right about this.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
What say you, Joe Biden? This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and let's all get decarbonized. That's what Jay Inslee, governor of Washington, says. He wants decarbonization, and that seems to be the goal. So I thought we'd talk to Todd Myers. He's at the Washington Policy Center. It's director of environmental services at Washington Policy. And what do those state agencies say is their priority for all that taxpayer money that is going to decarbonization projects? Todd, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on. And they say their project is government. not actually decarbonization or environmental benefit. And that's when you actually look at the documents that are produced by state agencies like the Department of Commerce and others, when they say, you know, here's the goal of the grants, here's the goal of the money we're spending, what they lay out is, here's some things we'll try to achieve, but at the end of the day, expanding government and protecting government is what they're about.
Well, in fact, they claim, as you point out at Washington Policy Center, that what is in the best interests of commerce is what the benefit should be. But Todd, is raising the cost of gasoline and diesel generically in the best interests of commerce in any way, shape, or form?
Well, it's in the best interest of the Department of Commerce, but it may not be in the best interest of the people of the state of Washington. So, you know, where I found this is I started going through. There's a claim that the reason we need this CO2 tax is because of all the money it provides to do good things for the state of Washington. And primarily among them, they always cite our environmental benefits and reduction in CO2 emissions. And so yesterday, the Department of Ecology released the latest numbers, which show that the cost is about 24 cents a gallon. So what do we get for that 24 cents a gallon? Well, the Department of Commerce uses the money generated to fund grants, and this one was called a community decarbonization grant. So you would expect that it would actually decarbonize the community. But when you look at the grant application, they openly say that projects will not be compared based on how effectively they are at reducing emissions. So then what will they be judged on?
Yeah.
What they say is that we reserve the right to do what is in best in the interest of commerce, capital C, the Department of Commerce, and the state of Washington. Well, who gets to decide what's in the best interest of the state of Washington? Well, the Department of Commerce. So they have all these things about, here's all the benefits, but at the end of the day, they say, the decision we're going to make is the one that's best for us.
How is it that that's living up to the so-called, and I'll use their name, instead of carbon tax, it's Climate Commitment Act. If they've truly made a commitment to improve the climate, even though you and I disagree, and you and I don't disagree with each other, but we disagree with their take that somehow, right, you know, that we have to solve the problem this way. But how in the world do they say helping a state government agency is the best way to make a commitment to the climate?
Well, it's a little bit of a bait and switch because, like I said, the title of the grant is community decarbonization. But when you actually look at where they give the points, it's not for decarbonization. It is for, you know, putting money into, you know, underrepresented communities. You get a bonus 5% if the contracts with your employees include labor-friendly provisions. So there's no guaranteed points in the grants for reducing CO2 emissions, but there are guaranteed points in the grants for doing things that the unions want. So that's what's going on here is that it's about politics. It's not about actually reducing CO2 emissions. And I will go even farther than that. When there are private CO2 reduction projects, whether they're in forestry or capturing methane from landfills or things like that, it's not merely that they have to prove that they reduce CO2 emissions. It is that they are monitored. And if they don't deliver like they promised, then the money is gotten, they give the money back. In the state, they don't even start by promising that they will reduce CO2 emissions, let alone say that if we don't meet our goals, you have to give the money back. It is very slipshod, and it's about a political agenda, and it's about agencies deciding what they want to do rather than living up to the promise of the
grant. Well, and it sounds like if their approach, Todd, is to say, let's not tie this to actual results, is it fair to conclude that's because they already know ahead of time it's not going to produce results? So therefore say, don't measure us on the results because we already know we're not going to produce results?
I don't know whether they know or don't know, but fundamentally they don't care. That's not the goal, right? The goal is to deliver money to selected communities and selected political agendas so that they can say, look how much money we spent on decarbonization grants and, you know, get the political benefit of doing that. And obviously, you know, the state agencies now have more money to spend and they are allowed to take a certain percentage of the money for their own administration and overhead. So they get to expand. So it's a win-win for everybody except the environment.
Can I drag you to the south side of the Columbia River for just a moment, even though your specialty at Washington Policy is the north side of the Columbia River?
Absolutely.
Okay, so here's the thing. City of Portland passes a thing called the Clean Energy Fund. And they say, we're going to fund this by charging taxes. And they tell the taxpayers, don't worry about it. We're charging this tax on large retailers. So Target and stores like that, Walmart stores like that. And you say, wow, I wonder where those stores get their money. Well, they get it from the consumer. So all this is a pass-through. Okay, that's objection number one. Objection number two, kind of like the pattern we've seen with Jay Inslee's Climate Commitment Act, where they said, we think it's going to raise this paltry little sum of money. Oh, we're shocked. Shocked, I tell you, that we're raising far more, $2 billion. We never thought we'd get that amount of money in. So that's similarity number two. And then number three, they just announced, we're going to take some money from the Clean Energy Fund. And you know what they're going to do? They're buying window air conditioners for poor people. Now, Todd, I'm not a Scrooge. I mean, if it's going to get hot in June and July and August and probably September, too, in the Northwest, having air conditioning would be very, very nice. In some cases, perhaps even life-saving for the elderly and people who have other problems and, you know, can't cool down. It does kill people. Heat does kill people almost every single year. So getting an air conditioner may be something that would literally save somebody's life. But when you go out and you say, we're going to take this, and they're billed by the Fish Wrapper, you know, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper newspaper, they bill it as they're giving away free air conditioners. Well, they cost somebody money. They cost the Clean Energy Fund money. But we're giving them away, and we're giving away to poor people right before an election. And you say, gee, there seems to be a pattern here. Raise the money under false pretenses. Say you're not going to get that much, and then act shocked when you do. And then take the money and spend it on stuff that is politically popular with the people you think are most likely to vote for Democrats. And it does become a partisan issue. They're not doing these little deals saying, you know, labor-friendly provisions because they think that's going to help Republicans. Jay Inslee and company are doing it because this is going to help Democrats in general. And I think Portland's doing the same thing. And they've lied to the taxpayers about it. They've said, you're not paying it. Walmart and Target are, except you're buying the things from Walmart and Target. We're giving away free air conditioners that are not really free. Oh, and by the way, we're going to let people burn up more electricity to get air conditioning while condemning air conditioning. Todd Myers from the Washington Policy Center. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Gun Control Explained.
Want to stop drunk drivers from killing sober drivers? Ban sober drivers. That's how gun control works.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm always glad to get to your calls, and I'll do that in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Got a little excited there. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can also vote in our poll on X whether or not the Democrats' idea that women must register for the draft for selective service is a good idea or not. I frankly don't understand why they're going that direction at all. Probably some twisted, perverted idea of equity or something like that. Instead, I want to talk about what happens when somebody is trying to gather petition signatures, and she's doing something that's allowed. It's a constitutionally protected right. And then she faces retaliation from the local government. Jim Burling joins me, Vice President of Legal Affairs at Pacific Legal Foundation. Jim, you folks are representing Ms. Gonzalez, are you not?
No, that's actually another entity that's doing that. We have been involved as a friend of the court in similar cases.
Would you mind telling my audience what happened to Ms. Gonzalez, why she ended up with so much trouble?
Yeah, so she ran basically on a platform to get rid of the city manager. She didn't like the city manager, thought the guy was doing a terrible job, et cetera, et cetera. So she got elected to the city council, and the she had a little bit of trouble getting onto the city council. The city manager tried to block her. That didn't work. She had to go to court, but she eventually got on the city council. And when she was there, she went and started collecting signatures on a petition drive to have the city manager removed. Well, that wasn't very popular either with the city manager or the other members of the city council. And she presented the petition, and there were questions raised about the petition, and the papers were going back and forth. And at one point in the process, she took the petition and put it in her briefcase or a brief bag, and it was there at the city council meeting. And she was asked, well, did you take that? She said, no, I don't think I took it. She says it was by mistake. Other people think, well, she deliberately took it. Doesn't matter. She had it in her possession, and she was charged a little while afterwards with taking a government document without permission, basically interfering with a governmental process. And she was actually arrested for that and spent a night in jail for that. And she argued, okay, I did, I picked up the petition. It was clearly that I had done that. I'm not denying that. But I really am just being prosecuted because I was doing something that was very politically unpopular in this little small town politics. And nobody else, she said, got charged with anything similar to this. The only other people that get charged over the years with issues dealing with interfering with government documents are people invading in fraud, tax fraud, drug crimes, things of that nature that she had nothing to do with. So the question before the court is, could she even raise this as a defense? The Fifth Circuit had said that she could only raise this issue in defense if she could prove that there were other people who were not arrested for doing the exact same thing. Well, come on, how many people are involved in taking petitions to the city council and then accidentally, or not accidentally as the case may be, putting them in your briefcase? So the Supreme Court said, no, she has a right to try to prove that this was a politically motivated prosecution, and she doesn't need to prove there is somebody exactly like her in order for her to raise this objection.
No, in fact, I think the first argument you mentioned, which is when she says, look, there are probably lots of people who take home documents from a public meeting, and maybe in some cases the document officially belongs to the government, but they're not doing it intentionally, and they don't get prosecuted for it. In fact, it's the first time I've ever heard of a case like that. Have you ever heard of one?
No, I've never heard of a case like this, because clearly it was politically motivated, and I don't think anybody is really denying that. Look, after she was arrested, the county DA refused to press charges against her, refused to continue the case, and dropped all the charges. I mean, clearly they didn't have a leg to stand on. What she did was innocent or stupid, one or the other, but certainly no requirement that for what she did she'd have to spend time in jail, which she did, and that she should be prosecuted for this. So I think it was clearly a political retribution because, nobody in their right mind is going to charge somebody for a crime like, or an alleged crime like this.
Well, and not only that, but she's the one who created the petition to begin with, then brings it to the city, and then at that point, in the eyes of the law, the document belongs to the city council. Is that why it is viewed as theft?
Apparently, yes. I mean, and there is a point there that she had this petition, she submitted it to the city council. At that point, it becomes city property, and she doesn't have any personal ownership rights over that anymore. And the city has insinuated, well, maybe some of the signatures weren't proper on there. Well, that's the standard thing you look at every petition. When you have any petition for a ballot measure, you always examine all the signatures on the measure. You make sure that they're all valid, and some of them are going to be thrown out. People or think they live in the county and they don't live in the county, or they sign a petition or whatever. That's pretty standard operating procedure.
Right.
So, yeah, she shouldn't have taken the thing back, but it was hardly a crime to do so.
Well, let me ask you this, Jim, because forgive my partisanship. You know, I'm a Trump guy, but it sounds like she's got a lot in common with Trump. And there I see the broader issue, which is, are we entering an era where government has begun to believe, government, in its totality, collectively, has said, the people serve us, not the other way around. It's not our job to serve the people. And if you attack somebody in government, not physically, but if you attack them by saying, I want this person removed, then the government will do everything it can. And the government has some pretty broad powers to go after citizens. And they're doing it with Donald Trump. They're doing it with Ms. Gonzalez, saying, if you come after us, don't doubt that we will use all the powers within our, you know, within our reach to be able to go after you. And you think about the various people who go appealing to their local government for a zone change or a permit to open a business or whatever it happens to be. And it sounds like if you're not on the right side with the folks on whatever government is, city, county, state, or federal, that they will come after you.
Yeah, we've seen time and time again people having permits denied to build things because they're unpopular. And you mentioned President Trump, which is quite interesting because one of the cases before the Supreme Court is a question of whether the January 6th rioters, when they went into Congress that day, were obstructing and interfering with government documents. I mean, a very similar issue is going on here. But I don't think what happened in this case is really any kind of predictor of what's going to happen in the government documents case of the January 6th defendants. But the government has tremendous power over everything we do. And that is disturbing because if we object to what the government is doing or if we're politically unpopular, that can be used against us.
Well, and in fact, the Constitution specifically says, I remind my audience of it all the time, you don't just have First Amendment rights of free speech and free religion. You have the right to peaceably assemble, and you have the right to petition your government for redress of grievances, which sounds like what Ms. Gonzalez was doing. And if the new rule is, well, you can petition for redress of grievances, you want the city manager fired? Fine. City Hall is going to come down on you like a ton of bricks.
It is disturbing because, as I said a moment ago, the government has so much power. And when you have constitutional rights, those constitutional rights are only as good as the willingness of the courts and the rest other branches of government to enforce them. And if you look at constitutional rights as something that can be violated if you're politically unpopular, that is quite disturbing. And that is a road that I hope we do not go down any further.
You and me both. That's Jim Burling from Pacific Legal Foundation. I'll get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LAW. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of... Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our poll on X today, because of this weekend speech by Joe Biden, a commencement speech at Morehouse University. Joe Biden claims black Americans have to be 10 times as good to get a fair shot at a job. Is that true? No, it's hogwash, but Joe's trying to pander to black voters by telling black Americans that America doesn't love black Americans and that black Americans have to be 10 times as good to get a fair shot at a job. This is Joe Biden pandering at his best. So I think it's hogwash. It is belied by federal and state laws that say you can't discriminate. It's not true at all. But you can find the poll on X. I'd say no. But it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Last week, I asked you, should both candidates submit to drug testing immediately before the first presidential debate? I said yes, so did 91% of you. Only 9% of you said no to that idea. Dear calls now. And if you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, and by the way, the X poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Tricia. And if you want to join in, it's 866-439-5277. Tricia, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey there, Lars. I've been listening to your show for a while, and
Thank you.
I'm young. I'm a voter. And my question is, how do I know if I'm a Democrat or Republican?
Now, are you pulling my leg? Because I'm happy to answer it. Seriously.
I'm very serious.
Okay. Can I tell you, and people will think I'm being disparaging, and you can take it any way you want. Democrats feel, and just use Democrats as substitute for liberal, progressive, whatever label they want. Democrats feel and conservatives think. And what I mean by that is a Democrat walking down the street will see somebody who's down and out, say a drug addict living in a tent on the street. And there's plenty of that going on in the Northwest. And the Democrat will say, well, let me tell you what the conservative will say. The conservative will say, I want to give that person an opportunity to quit the drugs and give them some help quitting the drugs. But they have to be in on it. They have to be a participant. Now, if you walk up and say, hey, would you like to quit drugs to an awful lot of fentanyl or methamphetamine users, they might say, well, yes, in theory, but they don't want to go through withdrawal. They don't want to go through the pain that's involved in withdrawing from drugs that they originally took voluntarily. The conservative will say, I want that person to have an opportunity to quit drugs and get a job and make their own way in the world. You know what the Democrat will do? The Democrat will reach over into the conservative's pocket, pull out any money that's in there and say, I'm going to give this money to this drug addict to make his life better. And the short quiz Trish, is, what do you suppose a drug addict would do with $100 if you put it in his hands?
Probably buy more drugs.
Yeah, there you go. See, you're well on your way. You're a conservative. Now, and the only question is, do you think about things and say, this is the right answer? And if your friends say, well, but no, it doesn't feel like we're helping people if we tell them they have to get off drugs. They have to work and support themselves. The thinking person is going to say, that's the right way to go. The feeling person is going to say, wouldn't it be easier just to take some money from other people who aren't addicted to drugs, who don't skip out on a job and their family and their responsibility? Why don't we just give them something and hope their life gets better? That's the Democrat approach to that particular problem. And you can apply it to almost anything. Hearing all that, would you then say you're a conservative or a liberal?
I would say I wouldn't want to give them money.
Good. That's a good start.
I wouldn't want to take money from other people because why would I want to take money from other people? Like, I work my butt off.
Yeah.
And I don't want no one taking my money and giving it to somebody for, you know what I mean? Like,
I know what you mean. Look, Tricia, I went to talk to a high school class a few years ago. It was before the pandemic. And there were about 100 kids there, and it was during their lunch hour. And I asked them toward the end, I said, it seems like a lot of you really like the idea of socialism. And they said, well, you know, some of them said, yeah, we do. And I said, how many in favor of socialism? And about half the hands of this 100 went up. And I said, I want to test and see if you're really serious. And I said, how many of you, out of you 100, how many of you have a 4.0 grade average, straight A's? And it got about 12 or 15 hands. And I said, now, how many of those with your hands up would take one of the points you earned, that 4-point average, and give up one of the points, so now you only have a 3-point, a B average, and give those extra points to the guy or gal who's got a C or D average. So that would bring them up. And you know what? About half of them, six of the 15 said, I will give up. And I said, but you worked for those grades. And now you want to give them away to somebody who didn't work as hard as you did in class. And they stuck to their position. And these were kids who were within a couple of years of the age of majority, you know, old enough to be considered adults. And they were willing to give up their own grade point average, which I don't think is admirable. If you worked for that A, you should keep that A. If somebody else only did D work, they should get a D. Do you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that 100%.
Well, there you go. Tricia, I think we have properly diagnosed you as a conservative. Is there anything you feel the least bit liberal about?
Well, I heard your trans thing. That pissed me off. That was, like, not cool. That boy, like, running against girls, like, was too big of a fancy to not run against guys because he knew he was going to lose.
Yep. I think you're definitely a conservative, Tricia. Good for you.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Lance Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I have to tell you something. Homelessness is becoming a very, very expensive thing to fund in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, you've got Puget Sound. They're spending hundreds of millions of dollars in the Seattle area. And then you have the news that in Portland, the county alone last year spent north of $500 million, $523 million spent. And some of it was spent on things that actually created other problems that cost more millions to straighten out. And we've talked to attorney John DiLorenzo about that, because John is the man who effectively won. He didn't have to go to court. They settled out. But he sued the city of Portland, saying you are violating the rights under the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And the city agreed, I think wisely, to settle that out, make some promises, pay some money, and get things straightened out. But now, attorney John DiLorenzo finds himself back in front of the city council, having to, I guess, put a warning shot across their bow, although that's not exactly a lawyer phrase. John, welcome back, and tell me what you educated the folks at the Portland City Council about today.
Well, thanks, Lars. Last week, we went before the city council because we discovered new information that disclosed that between the time of our settlement and the current period, the joint office, which is run by the county, had handed out 5,600 tents and 24,000 tarps. And at the same time, the city had been cleaning up 12,000 tents. So, you know, it's as if you're trying to mop up a water spill and the guy upstairs isn't turning off the faucet. And so that created quite a controversy. And at that point, Jessica Vega Peterson, who is in charge of the county joint office and many other aspects of the county, said, well, she doubled down. She said, we're going to continue to hand out tents, and even created a new budget for next year. So I took a look at our settlement agreement with the city, and the settlement agreement says neither the city nor any of its contractors shall hand out tents and tarps except under certain limited circumstances, which are detailed in the agreement.
Right.
And it dawned on me that this new deal to renew the joint office puts the joint office in the position of being a contractor. And I've just alerted to the city that if they don't require the county to adopt the same tent policy that they have, they'll be violating our agreement if they allow the county to use their money to continue to hand out tents and tarps.
And at this point, tell my audience, how much money is the city of Portland currently giving or plans to give to Multnomah County to create the problem that the city then has agreed not to create and has to clean up for more millions?
Well, I'm not absolutely sure. I think they've reduced their $42 million annual commitment to $25 to $30 million in that area. But what is even more important is the fact that they have had to pay a contractor $26 million for a four-year contract to clean up the very tents and tarps that the county, through its nonprofits, is placing in our neighborhoods.
Does anybody at City Hall or the county seem like they understand how abysmally stupid this would sound to an average citizen?
Yes.
They do? Are there people there who've actually got a clue?
Commissioner Gonzalez gets it. In fact, tomorrow morning, he has an amendment. And the amendment provides that the city will re-up the joint office on one condition, and that is that the county has to comport its tent and tarp distribution program to that which has been adopted by the city in our settlement agreement. And if they don't do that, then it's no deal. That's his amendment. Hopefully he will have three votes for it. And any of your listeners who are around, who are interested in this issue, should show up tomorrow to testify and get on the city website to testify to encourage them to adopt
Commissioner Gonzalez's amendment.
Now, let's say he's got currently has to get three other votes or two other votes in addition to his own. I know that under the new form of government, they're going to, I guess you're going to need 7 votes out of 12 or, you know, 6.5. I don't know how they split it up. But John, has he said that if he doesn't get the city to agree to that, which will cause them to be in compliance with the settlement agreement, that he's not going to, you know, he's not going to vote to authorize the thing at all? Because he's only one vote. But if he tells the rest of them, if you're going to knowingly violate this, you know, this agreement we have that was made out of court to not force a trip to court and a trial and everything else, is he going to say either go at it this way or I'm not backing any of this stuff?
Well, first of all, I've been really impressed with his leadership. Secondly, I haven't talked to him about that particular question because I think he has a good shot at getting his three votes. And I think if we can get the county to turn off the flow of tents and tarps to the nonprofits that are then putting all these tents and tarps into our neighborhood, that'll make a big difference.
Now, in this case, John, just so I understand this, if the city says to the county, we're only giving you this money if you agree to stop handing out the tarps, are they allowed some kind of workaround where you know, this money is fungible? They can say, well, we're not going to do it with your money, but we'll do whatever we damn well please with our own money? Or can they actually wall them in and fence them in so they can't get away with that?
Well, who knows what some people who are opposed to this policy are going to think of. But rest assured, many of us will be watching very closely.
Yeah, it's because this is just, I mean, it ought to be maddening to people, especially when they see one government spend over $500 million, another government that's funding it, and the problem is getting worse and worse every year. I mean, a few years ago, I actually asked Ted Wheeler at one of the rare times I could get a question to him at a press conference, and I said, is it fair to say you've spent $1 billion in the last 10 years? This is 4 or 5 years ago. He said, yeah, that's about what we've spent. And I said, is the problem better or worse than it was 10 years ago? He said, it's worse. And I said, so you've got a government that continues to spend literally billions of dollars knowing that their money appears to be making the problem worse and not better.
Absolutely. And, I mean, the amount of money we have spent on homeless services is shocking. And very little of it has gotten to homeless people. It has all been consumed by the homeless industrial complex, which are people in government and at nonprofits who, instead of being volunteers, are now, quote, professionalizing, unquote, earning big salaries. Look, if you're earning a big salary at a nonprofit and your job is all about homeless people, are you really that interested in homelessness going away?
I mean, isn't one of the ladies in one of those jobs making a couple $100,000 a year to run one of the agencies? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, these are, we are just wasting the money.
And no fix to it at all. That's John DiLorenzo. He won in that fight against the city. He's put a warning shot across their bow. And apparently, Rene Gonzalez has said, this is the way it's going to be. And that's going to go to the council tomorrow morning. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your phone calls and emails.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. They talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the interests of the Pacific Northwest. I'm old enough to remember when the largest public works boondoggle in the Pacific Northwest was the badly named WHOOP system, the Washington Public Power Supply System, that tried to build half a dozen nuclear power plants. They failed miserably. They wasted a gigantic amount of money. But these days, the biggest single public works job in terms of dollars has to be the interstate bridge replacement. And this is try number two for building a new bridge across the Columbia River, an Interstate 5 bridge that connects Oregon and Washington and is the biggest single choke point between Canada and Mexico on Interstate 5. And I think they're going to fail the second time around, and I'm sure they may not waste as much money. They wasted almost $200 million the first time around, but this one is going south in a hurry. And now we found out something that is brand new news. Can you imagine spending $7.5 to $9 billion on a bridge to make a bridge that is exactly the same size as the existing bridge that it's replacing? But more importantly, the current bridge allocates 86% of the bridge to cars and trucks and buses. The new bridge will allocate less than half of the bridge surface to cars and trucks and buses. And to explain why that's happening and why the folks planning this boondoggle think it's a good idea, I've invited John Leon, retired airline pilot, reporter, activist, candidate for the Washington House of Reps. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Thanks so much for having me on. As you said, the sales pitch for replacing the I-5 Interstate Bridge is that it's the only stoplight for international commerce from Canada to Mexico on the freeway. And yet their solution will allocate over half of the surface of the bridge to bikes, pedestrians, and mass transit.
So only 46% to cars and trucks and such, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And unbelievably, Greg Johnson is catering to the bike and transit community, refusing to reduce or eliminate traffic congestion. What a sad waste of taxpayer money.
And why are they doing it this way, John? I know you've been following this a lot more closely than I have, but what explains why they would say we need a new bridge, it should be the same size as the old bridge, even though it's carrying a whole lot more traffic today than it did decades ago when it was built, when both of the spans were built? Why would they say, well, we're going to build a bridge the same size and a whole lot less of it is going to be available to cars, trucks, and buses?
Well, sadly, they're listening to political special interest, mainly from Portland. Unbelievably, Greg Johnson, the program administrator, said building more through lanes does nothing. He told this to 16 legislators from Oregon and Washington on Monday, and then he followed up saying, we want to accommodate folks who do not drive. And of course, the reality is that overwhelmingly, people are using their privately owned vehicles to get to and from work, to use for running errands, going to the doctor and everything. And yet the political power of the bike community, of the No More Freeways community, seems to be carrying the day. It's a ridiculous waste of people's money.
I mean, even where the bridge sits, I mean, if you're in Seattle and you go across a bridge between one neighborhood and another one, at least you're going from somewhere to somewhere, and there might be an argument for making, you know, additional, say, sidewalks for pedestrians or places for bikes to run. But in the case of Hayden Island, if somebody's riding their bike from, say, Southwest Washington onto Hayden Island, Jansen Beach, Tina and I used to live on a floating home on Jansen Beach years ago. After that, where do you go from there on a bicycle or on foot if you're going south? Because you go into a sort of a light industrial no man's land for a big period of time before you ever get back to a neighborhood, don't you?
Exactly right. And in fact, the Interstate Bridge Program has admitted that nobody uses this for biking, walking, whatever. They show 0.2% of bridge crossings are what they call active transportation. People on bikes or pedestrians. There is absolutely zero need for any high capacity transit or for bike and pedestrian facilities, number one. And number two, if you want to add something for bikes and pedestrians, you could repurpose the existing bridge that's lower, use it for local connections for those bicyclists, for pedestrians, and actually build an interstate freeway from Southwest Washington and Vancouver over to Marine Drive and use that to actually move traffic, to move the cars and freight haulers in an expeditious manner.
And the current bridge has 84% of the bridge allocated to cars, trucks, buses, long haul, the whole nine yards, 84%, and they're going to just simply shift all of that extra space on the bridge that'll be the same size as the old bridge. They're going to shift it over to pedestrians and bicycles who aren't using the bridge?
Actually, they're going to build an even wider bridge. They're saying 270 feet wide for the new structure, and then they're altering the percentage of that surface area in favor of bikes and pedestrians and mass transit. It's hugely frustrating. One aspect of this, one of the state legislators, Shelley Boschart Davis, asked, well, listen, if over half the structure is going to be for bikes and pedestrians and transit, are you going to charge tolls for those bikers and pedestrians? Are you going to charge transit for the cost of that portion of the bridge? That'd be over $4 billion that the non-cars and trucks would have to pay if it were equitable. And, of course, they love to talk equity, but not when they're charging equity for pedestrians and bicyclists.
So there's not going to be any charge for bicycles and pedestrians, even though they're going to be using what promises to be a very expensive bridge. Let me ask you to hit one more time, or hit today, the cost. Right now, the official cost number is $7.5 billion, but that's up, I think, from the original $3.5 billion, and it's possible or almost certain that it's going to go much higher. What do we know about that?
Well, last December, Greg Johnson, the administrator, told the community that the price tag was going up, and he said he'd get to it later this year. We're now 6 months in, and there are no new cost estimates. Joe Courtwright estimated $9 billion. Currently, $2 billion of the $7.5 billion proposal is for the light rail component. Again, that's over a quarter of the whole thing for a mass transit service that nobody uses. So it's going to be outrageously expensive for the people. Oregon's out of money for their transportation projects, and yet they're saying the price tag's going up, and who knows where they're going to get the money. But the easy answer is most likely they're going to jack up the tolls that drivers will have to pay in order to cross the bridge. And of course, as soon as you put a price tag on crossing the I-5 bridge, everybody's going to divert to the free bridge, I-205, which is already congested, and it's going to make a nightmare.
And by the way, at $7.5 billion, how much money have they actually got committed to the project right now?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. They got $600 million from the feds earlier this spring. Washington State has allocated $1.1 billion. Oregon alleges they've committed $1 billion, but in reality, they've only allocated specifically $250 million with an IOU for another $750 million.
Sounds like they're at $2 billion and they need to get to $7
billion. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Ever wonder what a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And in the interest of full disclosure, we have a lot of social media outlets for the Lars Larson Show. YouTube is not one of them. And one of the reasons we've never gone on YouTube is that there's no point in building a following on a site that has been known over the years for its censorship of content. Now, if you censor content to take off illegal things, immoral things, yeah, I guess I'm okay with that. I don't want to see drug dealing. I don't want to see child molestation, all that garbage. They're right to take that down. But YouTube has famously censored a lot of things. And yet I got the impression recently that they'd gone an entirely different direction until now. The other disclosure I have is I own guns and I believe in the Second Amendment. So it makes me wonder why YouTube is now specifically censoring Second Amendment videos and why that's happening right now. Aiden Johnson joins me now, Director of Federal Affairs at Gun Owners of America. Aiden, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
What is going on here that YouTube has decided to specifically start going after content that is a pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun?
Yep, so just last week, YouTube increased its censorship of Second Amendment content, which is awful. The new policy change says that if they think your firearm is homemade, they're going to start censoring your content. If they think that you're firing automatically, they're also going to start censoring your content. And it's not clear how they're going to know whether or not your firearm was made in a factory or homemade, or whether or not if you're just firing a semi-automatic or a revolver or any other firearm quickly, if it will be counted as automatic. They don't really have a standard that they've set. But if your firearm falls into one of these subjective, vague categories, they're going to age restrict it. And that's not just so that, oh, okay, kids don't see this. When you're age restricted, you don't show up in YouTube's algorithm, and you're effectively unable to reach your audience that's subscribed. You won't show up on the homepage, and you'll only get notifications and people who search out your content explicitly. So this is really going to hurt all of the gun YouTubers who are still on the platform and are still trying to reach those gun owners that still watch YouTube.
And by the way, some content for kids involving guns I think would be great. The whole Eddie Eagle program, I know that comes from the NRA, not GOA, but I think both groups have valuable stuff. The NRA has had Eddie Eagle for a long time, specifically aimed at kids. Now, I don't know if they put it on online, but it's a great program. It tells younger kids, if you run into a firearm and there's no adult present, stop, don't touch, leave the area, tell an adult. And other programs work the same way. It's a sensible message that you can only get to kids if you, these days, if you go through social media. So what's driving this change by YouTube? Do you know? Do you have any idea?
Well, I would also note that there's lots of content for example, about high school shooting sports teams, or for how to go hunting if you're, you know, a younger adult or something like that. There's lots of content that someone who's under 18 that also has a firearm with the permission of their parents might want to access on YouTube. I think that YouTube is really just trying to crack down and bend to the anti-gun lobby. What happened here was all these anti-gun groups and all kinds of anti-gun politicians, including senators from Congress and also Alvin Bragg, the guy who's attacking President Trump in New York, have sent letters to YouTube saying, hey, why do you allow this? What's wrong with you? You need to age restrict this kind of content. And really what they're trying to do is attack lawful Second Amendment content that's posted on YouTube. Because if you look at this policy, there's actually an exception for movies, for video games, for military police footage, war zone footage. Like, why wouldn't you think that war zone footage or someone getting arrested or all these things, maybe we should automatically age restrict that if it's someone getting blown up in a war zone. But no, we're not going to automatically age restrict that. But if you show someone how to use an AR-15, that's going to get age restricted.
Well,
I think that's absurd.
By the way, Aiden, the first time I ever got a chance, and it was before cell phones and cell phone cameras and all that, but I went to a police range because I had some friends who were cops, and they said, hey, do you want to shoot a Heckler and Koch M&P5? And I said, yeah, I'd love to shoot one. Well, come on down to the range. And we did. Now, if cell phones had been around at the time, I'm reasonably sure, Aiden, that I would have said to one of them, hey, when I fire this, will you shoot some video? And I might have wanted to post it. That was legal. It's also legal in a number of states to own machine guns made before 1986, if you have the right tax stamps and all that ATF nonsense, that you can do that. They're going to restrict even that stuff, even if it's legal?
Yeah, no, that's and they said also that content depicting bump stocks will also be banned. And we just had the Supreme Court rule that bump stocks are not machine guns. They're just lawful accessories for a semi-automatic firearm. And now YouTube is banning footage of lawfully owned machine guns, lawfully owned bump stocks, lawfully made homemade firearms. I mean, this is Second Amendment protected activity. There's no reason you wouldn't want to show it to people. There's a lot of people that got into firearms based on video games. A lot of the younger generation, several people here in our office, myself included, my first firearm I bought because I liked shooting it in a video game. And there's an exception for that. And YouTube, the algorithm will show you if you play video games, sometimes it will recommend you a GunTube video. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think it's ridiculous, though, that these companies can make money off, and YouTube can make money off of guns and video games and reviews of guns and video games. But then if you make that real and you say this is lawful Second Amendment protected activity, now all of a sudden that's banned from their platform. And by the way, Hollywood, which hates firearms, hates the Second Amendment, but loves to put violence in their movies, their stuff's not going to be age restricted, just you being a law-abiding gun owner.
Now, you and the GOA have called out YouTube for doing this. There's a huge percentage of American households where at least one member of the household owns a gun. And even if they don't happen to own fully automatic guns, machine guns or rifles, that they're not going to like this. Do you think YouTube is going to lose on this, as the American public says, well, if that's the attitude you take toward gun owners, legitimate, lawful gun owners, I don't want anything to do with your content at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's over one in three households in the United States has a firearm. So it's up millions and millions of American citizens. And where YouTube's really gone too far here is by censoring lawful content, right? You mentioned earlier that crimes and stuff should be censored. And actually, YouTube has protections for if their users post criminal stuff, YouTube is not liable under Section 230.
Yep.
But they don't have the ability to just censor absolutely everything from their content, from their platform. That's censoring free speech that's supposed to be protected if YouTube's going to get this government protection from Section 230. So YouTube's definitely going too far by restricting lawful automatic firearms and bump stocks and all these other kinds of things that they've just added to this policy. So it goes too far, and we're investigating what to do about that. Gunners of America has sent a letter to YouTube demanding answers, and just this past week, Congressman Jim Jordan and the Weaponization Committee subpoenaed YouTube, or rather the parent company Alphabet, to find out who's behind this, whether or not they were pressured, what government agencies were weaponized, and to figure out what we can do to actually protect gun YouTube and all the millions of Americans that still watch it.
And by the way, if somebody posts a commentary, say, on a group of criminals who've been arrested, but it features the automatic weapons that were seized by the police, is that going to be censored as well?
You know, they have exceptions for the press and for police footage, and it's bad because the you're still going to see these absurd videos from, like, CNN where they say, oh, here's how a bump stock works, and it's totally wrong. And if you post a video of a bump stock or how it works, you're going to get banned, but CNN's got the exception. So they're still going to get to use YouTube to push against your rights. Meanwhile, you'll be censored from the platform, and millions of Americans that grow up and use YouTube will think, oh, firearms content is bad, and will never have it recommended to them.
Unbelievable. That's Aiden Johnson. And Aiden, I'm glad we stayed away from YouTube. I'll continue to do that. That's Aiden Johnson with Gun Owners of America. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, it's Veronica.
At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the last quarter of a century. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medication specialists. Oh, and by the way, our X poll today, should we ban non-citizens from voting and from being counted in the census? As citizens, I would say yes to that idea. House Republicans put out a bill this week that would ban non-citizens from voting in federal elections. I think that's an important thing to do. And the House will vote this week on legislation that would require a citizenship question on the census. So you'd be counted, you just wouldn't be counted as a citizen. And that means that non-citizens would not be counted for congressional and electoral college representation. And that's one that apparently grabbed the ear of Wayne, who's calling in from Gig Harbor, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI. Hey, Wayne, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. So I am not a citizen. I am a permanent resident here in the U.S. I've done everything legally. I've done everything correctly.
Good for you.
I'm just wondering where you would put me into this by saying, yes, only citizens should be counted on the census.
Well, do you mind if I modify that a bit? Because the legislation on Capitol Hill, I framed it inartfully. They would count everybody, but there would be a citizenship question. So you'd know at the end of the day, I think we're right around 330 million. You might say, well, we have 330 million people in the United States. And among those are, I can't remember how many green card holders there are like you. But say you said, the current number is 30 million illegal aliens or so, somewhere between 20 and 30 million. And then we've got another certain number of people who are non-citizens, but they're legally here. You just wouldn't be counted as a citizen. And then I'd ask you this. Well, no, go ahead. You wanted to say something about that.
Oh, no. I'm listening. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious. If you're not a citizen and, but you're here legally, and you could become a citizen at some point if you decide to do so and you stay here 5 years and you take the test and all that. But let's say you don't want to do that. Should you be counted for congressional representation? And should you be counted for electoral college representation, which relates to the number of senators and reps that we have for each state? Do you think you have a right to be counted for that purpose, even though the purpose is representation of the U.S. Congress and whether and how we choose the president?
I would say yes, because I am here legally. I have done things correctly. I'm a full taxpayer. I follow all the rules.
But you can't vote.
Correct. I can't vote in the federal elections. Now, if a state was to decide I'm going to allow permanent residents to register to vote, just so you know, just so I'm honest, I do not vote. I don't believe I have the right to vote. I believe that is an honor and privilege of citizens at this point in time.
Good.
Now, if Washington State was to say, as a permanent resident, you've done everything legally, you've done everything correct, we're going to allow you to vote in local elections and the state election, I would take that as a privilege, and I would hold that very dear to my heart, and I would do that honestly.
Okay, and that's an honest way. But let me ask you this then. So when we're choosing the president, there are two parts of the process. People get to vote, and there's the popular vote, which apparently Hillary Clinton got it confused and thought it was the popular vote, and she got the popular vote against Donald Trump. She didn't get the Electoral College vote. That was put in for a very specific reason. The founders were brilliant in adding the Electoral College, because otherwise presidential candidates wouldn't have to give a damn what people outside of the biggest, most populous states thought. They could run in New York, California, Illinois, maybe Texas, and maybe Florida, and they could win the whole thing and it just ignore the rest of the country. So if your vote can't be counted,
I think that is one of the smartest things to ever happen is the
Electoral
College. I'm a Canadian by citizenship. But I think the U.S. system with the Electoral College is the best system out there.
Because they knew, even with 13 colonies, they knew, and they couldn't have ever imagined that someday there'd be a state like California with 40 million people and a state like North Dakota that I think still has less than a million people. And you say, how do we square this up so that presidents don't just run for the biggest population centers and represent their interests? But if we don't count your vote for president, why should we count your presence in the state toward the Electoral College vote?
So you don't, because the Electoral College is not.
But you do.
I don't believe it counts.
No, but today. You do, and here's why. The Electoral College has to do with how many senators and reps each state has. So if California has, I can't remember, is it 59 now? 59 reps and two senators, that's 61. But let's say each rep is about 800,000 citizens. So if you add 2.5 million illegal aliens, that's good enough to get you three more members in Congress and three more Electoral College votes.
Okay.
Even though those people
but
can't vote, they get counted.
Very important statement right there.
Yeah.
You made a very important statement. You said illegal aliens. I'm not illegal.
Oh, I know you're not. But I'm saying this applies.
But you're lumping me in with illegal.
Well, okay, then let me ask you this. If a state has an extra 800,000 legal aliens who've come here and done it the right way, should, even though their votes cannot count for president as the popular vote, they should count as part of the electoral vote?
That's a tough question, and honestly, I don't know how to answer that.
I try for tough questions, Wayne. Apparently, I've hit the mark today. Thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show.